Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Yes, hello out there, everyone, and welcome back to None But the Brave, a presentation of Evergreen Podcasts. I am Hal Schwartz, and as always, I'm here with my great buddy Flynn McLean. And Flynn, unfortunately, tonight we start with a bit of sad news and an appeal. Jesse Malin, who is a fixture of the music scene in New York City on the Lower East Side, and of course, someone who Bruce has played with many times, tragically suffered a rare spinal stroke on May 4th and is currently paralyzed from the waist down.
Yeah, very, very sad news. And a recovery fund has been set up to help him. Just go to sweetrelief.org/Jesse Malin to donate.
Yeah, and we donated. And certainly, if you have a couple of extra bucks, think about it. It's just reading the details in Rolling Stone, it truly is a tragic situation.
Yeah, and Jesse's done a lot to help out other musicians and other people in that community over the years, especially during COVID. So I think it's time to repay him and help him out a little bit.
Shifting back to Bruce's tour, there have been a couple of shows over the weekend. He played in Werchter, Belgium. There have been some minor changes to the show and also an omission at the Belgian show that is notable.
Yeah, he pulled out Working on the Highway in Darlington County last week, and then the last couple shows he's done My Hometown, which was a tour debut, and then The River, which has gotten very, very favorable reviews. Sounds like it gives the show a little bit more emotional depth. But yeah, at today's show, June 18th in Belgium, he dropped Letter to You, the title track, obviously from the 20 album. And yeah, that's not in the right direction for me. I guess the changes that we've gotten were positive. They were a start anyway, but to drop one of the new songs, not the best step right now.
There's been some information that perhaps he had to play a shorter show because it was a festival type setting and there was a time limit. But even if that's the case, dropping Letter to You over some of the other songs to me makes no sense. We started with 8 songs off of Letter to You and Only the Strong Survive in Tampa. And now we would be down to 4 total from those records. As you just said, that is definitely not a move in the right direction.
No, there's several of the songs I think he could have dropped. East Street Shuffle, Kitty's Back come to mind first off, but obviously doesn't seem to want to drop those as they seem to shine a light on the extended band. But still, maybe cut something from the encores. I don't know. But I guess with The River there, it really became more of a greatest hit set than it already was.
And The River is a much better selection than what it replaced, Johnny 99. Now, I'm sure it's the total coincidence, but in our last episode, we sort of deconstructed the 2023 version of Johnny 99. And I believe since then, it's been dropped entirely. So,
again, yeah, let's not screw our arms up, patting ourselves on the back, because I don't think that's the situation.
I'm sure we had nothing to do with that. But narrative-wise, much better, I think, with My Hometown, followed by The River into Last Man Standing.
My concern, though, would be that it's just too many slow songs in a row. Of course, The River is one of his legendary songs. So I think if he loses anybody during My Hometown, he definitely would get him back during The River. And obviously, the story preceding Last Man Standing always seems to get the crowd's attention, and he's able to hold them in his palm for the most part.
And moving on to tonight's main topic, this week marks the 30th anniversary since the legendary Concert to Fight Hunger, which took place at Brendan Byrne Arena on June 24th, 1993. Of course, that is an archive release. And we've previously looked at the Vietnam Vet Show. We did a show on the famed Coliseum stand. And tonight we're going to turn our attention to this show, which I have to say was perhaps the most dramatic concert I've ever attended.
Dramatic? I guess that's because of the way they set up the entrance of a certain saxophone player, huh?
Well, I mean, we're getting ahead of ourselves and you're jumping all the way to the end. But yes, there are few shows that have made my blood pump like this one. Now, I was only 24 years old. I was very excitable at the time. And this was a night that built, of course, as you just mentioned, incredible things happened in the encores. And people knew that that was going to happen. And just the drama to get there and the quality of the performance. For my money, and I love the Count Basie show, but for my money, this was by far the best performance by this band.
Okay. You see, I was getting a little worried there that you were just going to focus entirely on the encores and ignore the first two sets,
no.
which were just as amazing and just as great as anything they had done for, during the encores. And it was an excellent performance. It was a pretty, I mean, relatively standard for what they had been doing all spring in Europe. So there weren't too many out of left fields. I guess the opener, I Ain't Got No Home. And then I guess this was only the second performance of Bus Stop, basically since 1975, right? And with the first one being, of course, at the Count Basie.
Yes, that is correct. And I think we should set the stage as to what was going on here. I don't know if any of our listeners really aren't familiar with this period, but of course, after the Tunnel of Love and the Amnesty tours, Bruce went his own separate ways without the E Street Band. This was a tour he did with new musicians, and it was very polarizing within the Springsteen community. And they arrived after a European tour in 1993, back in the States to do two shows only in the U.S., one at Brendan Byrne, which was this Concert to Fight Hunger, and the second would be the Kristen Ann Carr benefit at the Garden two nights later. And I think we can safely say the fan base was still doubting this band at this point, correct?
I wasn't plugged in any way, except for basically Backstreet's magazine and the hotline. So I really wasn't familiar with what people were saying about the band, unless it reached the level of Backstreet's of the magazine and the hotline. But I was all in on these guys. At that point, I loved everything that Bruce did. I loved the albums, loved the tour. I really enjoyed calling in and hearing the set list every night on the hotline. And I was ready for this show. It was going to wrap up the tour. I had just graduated from college. Kind of like a bookend, actually, to my senior year of college. Obviously, I saw four shows two at the Meadowlands and two at the Capitol Center right outside D.C. just before senior year started. And then just a few weeks after graduation, driving up to Brendan Byrne.
And coincidentally, this followed my third year of law school. I would shortly graduate and pack up and move to Los Angeles, where I've been for the last three decades. So I think for both of us, there's a sense, I don't want to say melancholy, would you say that excitement of we were moving on to new phases in our lives. And these shows represent, artistically at least, sort of in our minds, the gateway to those changes.
Well, I would say it was kind of a, I don't know, can we call it a Bruce graduation ceremony? I feel like for both of us, I didn't realize you moved to LA just after these shows.
Yeah.
But for both of us, it was kind of like, okay, we finished up one phase of our lives, getting ready to start a new one. And I feel like Bruce's, this show, and obviously, and for you, I didn't go to the Garden show, that they kind of provided a, like I said, a graduation or a start or a fresh start to what lay next.
And just as we were finishing up phases of our lives, I think we can safely say Bruce was finishing up a phase of his life. Perhaps he didn't know it at the time. He did go on and try and record with this band, but as we know, that was never released. And he moved on instead to reuniting briefly with the E Street Band and then went on to the Joe Tour. before finally reuniting full-time with E Street Band in the late 90s. So this was a day, I remember it so vividly. There was a lot of excitement because Clarence was on. It was Mike and the Mad Dog, right?
You know, I have no idea. I was not in, tapped in any way to New York Radio.
Did you not know?
I did not.
Oh, because Clarence was on. It was, I'm 99% sure it was on the classic sports show, Mike and the Mad Dog. Chris Russo in particular is a huge fan of Bruce. He is to this day. And he sort of gave away that he was going to be at the show. Now, also, and I attended the show with your lovely wife, and it's just so funny thinking back on these things. We're lucky we're still not caught in traffic. We were supposed to go and meet up with people from, I think it was the old Prodigy board, but the first incarnation of Springsteen fans on the internet. And there was a tailgate going on, and Claudine was going to pick me up and we were going to go. And I remember to this day, I was like, she went up the West Side Highway to the George Washington Bridge. And we're lucky we're still not there. So we missed the tailgate with all of the internet fans, which at the time seemed so novel. You know, you think back to these days and like, we were all meeting for the first time, and some of those people have become lifelong friends. And as we've said before, without that entire community, certainly this podcast would not exist, and you would, of course, not be married.
That's true. And my own little personal story was that I tried for tickets. I didn't get them. And then I kept calling every morning, as Backstreet had suggested to do, in case there was a drop. Never got one. Finally, I just said, I'm just going to go up without a ticket. And I did. First time I ever did that. Found a ticket in the parking lot, paid $80, which is almost everything I had in cash in my wallet. But it was in the last row. I believe you were on the floor, probably within the first 10 rows. And
no, we were not in the first 10 rows. I think we were in like the 15th or the 16th row. One of the things that happened was I'm pretty sure we got our tickets from a broker. And we had paid, it was a decent amount, but it wasn't crazy. And of course, this was 1993. But we had put all our eggs into the Garden show because, of course, it was going to be the final show. That was sort of a miscalculation because, needless to say, the second to last show wound up as the better show.
Well, you didn't know that at the time.
No, but we had no way of knowing that.
No, but I ended up in the, like as I said, I think second to the last row in the upper deck on the opposite side of the arena from the stage. So I was really far away, but I went in early. I was hoping to get Man in Black, MIB, but I was by myself, so he totally ignored me. I did see him upgrade somebody, so that was kind of cool to see. But I made some new friends up there, so it actually worked out pretty well.
Now let's go to the start of the show. As you said, it opened with "I Ain't Got No Home." In a way, this was one of the precursors to something Bruce would do with "If I Should Fall Behind," because he had a group of vocalists on stage, himself, Joe Ely, some of the background vocalists, including Bobby King, and they all took lines within the song. And that was, I think, the first time he'd ever done anything like that.
That sounds about right. I remember feeling the tension in the song and the way that it started off with Roy's synthesizer or Roy's keyboards. And they each, as you said, they each took a few lines. And I remember going, who is that? Who is that? When Joe Ely was there, I don't think I fully identified him until much later, maybe by the time we got to the encores. And it was cool to see Bobby King take a line. Tommy Sims took a line. And I remember how when they all came together at the end, how it felt like the tension, it was building and it felt so good. But then I got to be honest, though, when he went into the other three acoustic songs, a lot of that tension left. I feel like it might have been better if he had gone straight into Better Days. But at the same time, I know that he was doing the three acoustic songs to open each show in Europe. And of course, that goes back to the basic.
Oh, I don't know. I thought the three acoustic songs worked really well. Seeds to me really reads in that arrangement sort of like Dylan. And then you got Adam Raise the Cane. And of course, This Hard Land, which most of the audience was hearing for the first time live or perhaps ever, because of course it was at that point unreleased. And I thought the opening to that show was very effective. He was setting a tone, and the "I Ain't Got No Home" in particular was very emotional. We all understood mm-hmm. why we were there. And I thought it all just played very well. And it made sense then that he would kick into better days. And from there, we were off and flying.
Well, I think this is where my seats actually played a role in how I was interpreting these songs, because I felt like he had lost everybody around me, basically. You know, as I said, we were basically in another zip code. And I feel like there was just a lot of talking, a lot of conversation going on, which made it difficult to focus on hearing these songs. And I got to say, you know, you and I had heard this Heartland through the magic of bootlegging at this time. So we were kind of singing along to it, I'm sure. Both of
well,
us.
And I had seen it at the Basie, of course.
There you go. There you go.
An incredible moment that really is hard to imagine that it actually happened. But one other thing I'll point out about the acoustic set and listening to the archive release, you can hear the crowd is really revved up. When he's talking before the intro to Adam Raise the Cane, I just felt it was sort of like it was a pressure cooker, that arena that night. And we were just waiting for sort of the cork to pop. And of course, that wouldn't happen for another 2.5 hours or so.
But it still kind of popped when he went into Better Days, though. I think that yeah. release... That release from the acoustic, the attention that created by the acoustic opening, and certainly the I Ain't Got No Home, really made that one explode, I think, even more than it had a year previous.
And Better Days was always highly effective. It's a great song. As we know, he probably should play it more. And I think the crowd really enjoyed it. By then, whatever reluctance they had towards the band, and without question, I think that existed, as I said earlier, they were into the songs. Better Days, Lucky Town was tremendous.
Mm-hmm. It sure was. I remember hearing that solo. That solo just kind of went on, and that was great. And I love hearing it on the archive. It's one of my favorite songs from the album, and certainly on that tour as well.
Yeah, and the version of Atlantic City in 93 was always great. I think that they had hit a groove somewhere in Europe. You know, when we were at the Count Basie and we saw all that rare material, one wouldn't have known how that was going to translate. And for the most part, some of those songs weren't either played at all again, or they were played maybe once. I think Point Blank Acoustic was played once or twice. He went back to relying on a lot of the material from the two new records. And he also, as we'll see here, started bringing in covers that more effectively utilized the band than perhaps he had been doing in 1992.
I feel like Atlantic City was one of the better songs that utilized the backup singers. Darkness
yes.
was too, interestingly
yeah.
enough. But of course, those he had been playing all the previous fall and summer. But I guess, are you jumping ahead to Satan's Jeweled Crown when you say that?
Yeah, that was what I was thinking. But let's talk about 57 Channels, because for all the discounting we do of the song, listening to this archive the other day, it was really fiery that night.
It was good, except I don't think the call and response, I don't think that aged very well at all. That's kind of cringe at this point. But up until then, I thought, yeah, it worked really well. And it was really cooking. And it's funny. It's, as you said, it's not a song that it's popular for a lot of people, but he really went all in on that song back in 92, 93, like it or not. And they nailed the performance of it, and they made it interesting, if nothing else.
Nothing if not interesting. And that was followed by Badlands. Now, Badlands to me was always the weakest of the E Street Band songs that he played with the 92, 93 band. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it may not have translated as well. I certainly, without the sax solo in the middle, it lost something. But at the same time, it goes along with the whole give the people what they want, and people wanted to hear the familiar E Street stuff, even if it wasn't E Street. So the crowd was into it, but granted, it hasn't aged well. If I want to listen to a version of Badlands, obviously I'm not going to this tour, but people were into it, and it got the crowd going. So it's kind of hard to criticize it at this point.
That was really where the tension existed, as we know, because if Bruce had probably had his choice, he might have played no E Street Band songs on this tour. And early on, he discovered that there needed to be some give for audience reception. And some of the songs worked incredibly well. Atlantic City that you mentioned, Darkness, But Badlands, to me, it has always sounded thin in with this band.
Exactly.
It's lacking the sax solo. Zach Alford is a world-class drummer. For anyone who wants to take shots at him, he's played with Bruce, Billy Joel. He played with Bowie. He's just top-notch. But this was not a song that showcased him well.
You know what was really missing for Badlands was Danny or an organ. Roy can only do so much over there. But so when I heard it the other day, listening on headphones, I kept expecting to hear Danny's incredible organ playing in my left ear, and it just wasn't there. And I think that adds a considerable amount to the thinness that you were talking about.
And next up was Satan's Jeweled Crown, which we mentioned a little earlier. What did you think about this one?
Well, it's a country gospel song, as Bruce described it when he introduced it. And I'm the son of two big bluegrass fans. And actually, when I heard it was debuted in Europe the previous month, I actually went and tracked down their went through the record collection to find it. And it was on one of Emmylou Harris's albums. And I put it on and just loved it. And just to hear Bruce do it and that kind of arrangement was just beautiful.
It's a completely stunning version, and it really showcased the vocalists, again, in a way that the 92 segment of the tour, I think, failed to do.
Yeah.
One thing that we can debate is whether the fans would have been more accepting of this band had he gone in a direction further from the E Street Band. And, of course, this is something that's been debated for a long time. Because he really didn't go as deep into a change of sound as you would have expected with the band that he put together, at least originally when the tour commenced in 1992.
You are right. He was trying to get away from the E Street sound, but he couldn't do it. He probably couldn't do it as much as he had initially wanted to do it. I think he did feel there was enough pressure from the fans to hear the E Street stuff. There's the famous story about, was it the second or third night in Italy? And they were just chanting for Born to Run. So from there, it was just hard to not play it. I think he did a great job with Thunder Road, making an acoustic version instead of the full band. And that's, I think that's aged better than Born to Run from this tour. But I don't know if he really, I don't know how accepting the fans would have been at the time. That's a big question. I mean, looking at the set list, there are already only one, two, three E Street songs in the whole first set. And then one, two, three, four, five, I guess about five or six in the second set. So it was still about, I don't know, about half and half E Street and non E Street. I don't know how much more he could have gone.
You're not counting the acoustic songs, because of course all three of those are also E Street Band songs.
No, I was not. Atlantic City, Badlands, My Hometown. That's three.
Right. Yeah. And then Seeds.
I'm not counting Seeds. It's an acoustic song.
Okay.
And then
fair.
In the second set, you got Because the Night, Brilliant Disguise, The River, Who'll Stop the Rain, and USA. In light of day, I guess that was basically E Street after it was played every night on the Tunnel of Love tour.
Well, let's get back to the first set. One of the E Street songs was next. That was My Hometown. Of course, it made total sense on this evening. It was a show that was designed to highlight issues going on in the tri-state area and really nationwide in terms of World Hunger Year. But it was
almost an every nighter, though. It wasn't like he pulled it out special for New Jersey. It was basically played every night on that tour.
Even in Europe 93?
I'm going back. Yeah. My home. Yeah.
Oh, I actually didn't even realize that.
Yeah, it was played at most shows, and maybe every night was overstating, but it was certainly done at most shows in Europe.
Again, it worked really well on this night, and there was just a build to the show, and this was a part of it as we were getting to the end of the first set. I think the word that we should use is anticipation. There was an anticipation rising through the crowd for really the entire show.
I think that about sums it up. And to their credit, to the crowd's credit, they didn't try to push that. They let the show play out, and they were able to really appreciate what was happening on stage as it happened, and weren't just entirely looking forward to the encores, where I guess apparently most people knew, except for me, that Clarence was going to show up. But yeah, you're right, and I think that did give it that anticipation also added some tension to it in terms of this is great and the show is playing out really well, and but we're looking forward to exploding later.
That really does explain the final three songs of the set. And those have become, I think, fan favorites at this point. Leap of Faith, he jumped into the crowd. There was a hilarious moment after the song where he had lost one of his boots, I think, taken off of him.
I don't think it was lost. I think someone took it off.
Well, lost is a euphemism for it was stolen.
And you can hear him on the recording saying, yeah, I lost my shoe, and he was calling back for another one. So I assume that he always has a backup of everything he wears. And then he actually said, oh, she can keep it. But she gave it to him.
Well, you also hear him say, get me an acoustic guitar for Bus Stop. Because apparently he was going to play Bus Stop to kill some time there while he found his footwear.
Exactly. So that would have been really interesting because, first off, I believe it would have been the only time on the tour that he played something else within those three songs. I think in Philly.
You're right.
I think in Philly in December, there was some kind of piano jam when he had to take a bathroom break.
There was like a boogie-woogie jam. We were there.
There you go. But otherwise, this would have been the only time that an actual song would have been performed within that trio. And then it got moved to the start of the encore. So I wonder what would have happened had he
Start of the second set.
Right. My bad. Yeah, he would have started the second set with something different other than 82nd Street. So that would have been,
right.
You know, the alternate history there.
Well, the first set concluded with Man's Job and Roll the Dice, which included Everybody Needs Somebody to Love. And then the lights came up. I don't fully remember what I did during the break, but I definitely remember that as we got closer to the second set starting, there was that sense of anticipation we talked about, and it was really starting to be elevated. You could feel it. It was quite palpable in the building.
Well, I have no recollection of what I did during the break. I probably talked to some people around me. Not sure if I got a drink or not. But I didn't know. I had no idea what was coming. So I can't say that I was feeling that sense of anticipation as well.
So as the second set is now starting, obviously he comes out, he opens with Does This Bus Stop. Do you recall what you were thinking? Were you surprised that that was something that was being played?
Pretty much, yeah. Like, holy crap, he's doing Bus Stop. But then, of course, at that point, I'm able to go, yeah, he did it back in back at the Basie, but he hasn't done it since. So I was able to kind of recall that. So I knew something special was going on, and I loved Roy's contribution to it on keyboards. I thought that added a cool element as well.
Bruce was really locked in the whole night, but starting with the Bus Stop, you could really tell he was focused and he was on. And that continued as we went at the Because Tonight. This was a song I really enjoyed with the 92-93 band. It's perhaps played at a slower pace than with the E Street Band, but I thought it worked really well.
Oh, I agree. I thought this one worked tremendously well on this tour. And I thought the band really brought something to it. And of course, Bruce's guitar playing was off the charts.
Just really great stuff. And the show was about to take off. He brought out Patty for Brilliant Disguise, and there was a really sweet moment at the end of the song. I think he surprised her because they had never done anything like that, I don't think, on a public concert stage. And he took her in his arms, and they started slow dancing, and it was just so sweet and so tender.
Okay. I don't remember that, but I hear him on the recording say, dance with my wife. But then apparently she went backstage and kind of disappeared because he wanted her to come back out for Human Touch. Do you remember what kind of what things were like on the stage at that point?
It's hard to recall exactly. I think he did surprise her with the dance and she got a little
off kilter there.
Exactly. And then she was supposed to stay for Human Touch, but I think she just forgot about it and left. And you hear the commentary that he's making. You're right. He's like, she left. Where did she go? And then they finally, I guess, found her and she came back out. And that, again, is a wonderful version of Human Touch.
But what's interesting is that this was pretty much, except for one song, this was pretty much the second set that he was playing throughout Europe. And so it was good to have her back on Human Touch after she hadn't been in Europe for most of the tour and where she did play on the previous fall and summer.
She did a great job on that tour. It was obviously only guest spots, but I thought she really added something to both songs, and that was especially true during this show.
Exactly, exactly. And she would also come back out for the encores to add some vocals, but I think everybody on the Jersey Shore came out for the encores. Well, we'll get to that. And then we followed Human Touch with The River, which was another tremendous version. Now, one thing I want to point out to people is Shane Fontaine doesn't get a lot of respect, I don't think, among the fan base. But listen to what he's playing in the left channel. And he's really doing some interesting stuff there on an acoustic. And he really should be more respected, I believe, from people like us, from the fans. Because he did a tremendous job on that tour. And I don't think he got nearly enough respect.
That's 100% accurate. And look, they had one thing against them, this band. They weren't the E Street band. And that wasn't their fault. If you were going to be mad at anyone, be mad at Bruce for selecting them and for getting rid of the band, the E Street band. But these were very talented musicians. And by this point, as I've said, they were very locked in. The Who'll Stop the Rain worked incredibly well. And then there was a fiery version of Souls of the Departed. And this is really where the show... Mm-hmm. The parts from the other shows that he had played, because Souls of the Departed was coming to an end, and at every show it had gone into Born in the USA. And I remember seeing him turn and saying something, and suddenly the band went into what became Living Proof. And it was just such a shock because they had been doing the same thing night after night after night, and now something else was in there. But it was also tonally and in terms of a narrative, going from Who'll Stop the Rain to Souls of the Departed, and instead of going straight into Born in the USA, putting in Living Proof after Souls of the Departed, I thought it was just stunning. And that was the best version, for my money, of Living Proof that's ever been played.
Okay, I can believe it. It was usually played on that tour in the first set, right after, I believe, Satan's Jewel Crown. And or after My Hometown, and it absolutely had an extra layer of power at this show coming out of Souls of the Departed, because Souls did not end. He segued right into Living Proof, and I think that hit a little bit harder. And of course, the fact that he's talking about his son being born in Living Proof and coming out of Souls of the Departed, where the second verse talks about a murdered child in L.A., I think that gave it a little bit more texture.
For sure. And of course, if we ever did get a chance to speak to him, we could never ask every question we wanted to. But it is so interesting because that seemed like such a compelling pairing. And I think it was pretty much off the cuff that he decided to do that. What in that moment suddenly came into his head like, wow, if I play Living Proof here, it's going to really connect everything, because I feel that's what the song did there. And then the Born in the USA. Now, this is a polarizing version of Born in the USA, because how do we describe it? I think he sang it in a totally different cadence than he had previously and really ever since. It's a one-time only performance of the song.
Yeah, the phrasing is a little bit different, and it doesn't... Some of it works, but most of it doesn't for me. But it's such a powerful, powerful song that it's still okay with me. But the Nowhere to Run, Nowhere to Run, Nowhere to Hide, the way he says that is kind of it's kind of cringeworthy at this.
See,
point.
I don't feel that way.
Okay,
in a way, I don't. You think he did that to prevent people from singing along? That seems to me, when I was listening to it the other day, that was what I finally concluded, that it was like coming after Who'll Stop the Rain, Souls of the Departed, Living Proof. He did not want people singing along in a jingoistic manner with Born in the USA.
But everyone was singing the chorus anyway. They didn't need him rephrasing it or putting it in a different cadence, as you said, to sing that. So I'm not really sure that totally worked, if that was his intent. But coming out of the previous two songs, as you said, was always a highlight for me. Coming out of Souls of the Departed, I thought that combo was always powerful, and Living Proof did not really take away from that power.
Oh, I think it added to it. And again, this was in terms of a complete hour or so. just, to me, the high point of this band. And I know people are going to say, well, what about the encores? Obviously, the band wasn't alone at that point. I'm talking about just when this band was on stage and it was that one entity. I thought this entire show, I remember that the feeling in the arena, everyone knew they were seeing a great show, even without what was to come. This was, if he needed to win the audience over for this band, he did it on this night for with this crowd.
I can see that. They were, everything was on. It was this was a show they had been playing for 2 or 3 months in Europe. It was down. They had it down, and it was, it's not really that much different than that Berlin show they released from May 14th. And that was an extremely well-performed show as well. And they just had it. As you said, they were on this night. I think all the factors that you've already mentioned, the anticipation, the tension, the way that they were, it was his hometown crowd. I believe that contributed as well. And hopefully that audience was, I'm sure they were more open to this band at this point because they knew this was the only time that he was going to be playing that year anywhere in the States, except for, you know, two nights later, but that was it. But yeah, he had him in the palm of his hand for this one.
And the second set ended as all the shows did with Light of Day. And just another Titanic version of the song, and very lengthy for sure, which I'd sort of forgotten about before listening the other day. I was like, how long does this go on for? But it was so much fun when he did that shtick with turning his head and the crowd cheered in one segment, and then he turned his head to another segment of the crowd and they cheered. Some of it is just nostalgia for me, and perhaps people are like, okay, it's too much, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I was realizing that he went on a little bit too long with that, but it was kind of, what's cool about it now anyway, is that you hear him, you hear the crowd in the left channel and then the right channel and then the left channel. And so that kind of gives you a sense of what Bruce himself was hearing on stage just by a slight turn of his head. So that was, that really showed his power there, what he can do with just a head turn.
and he of course had the crowd guitar, in the palm of his hands.
Right. But, and of course his guitar playing on that one was amazing. Go back to the version from Unplugged, and I think this one tops it tenfold.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.
Again, just a fabulous show, and we were just getting started. They left the stage. Do you remember what you were thinking? Well, you didn't know Clarence was there, so
I had no idea.
Your perspective on the show at this point is a lot different than mine, because I'm sitting next to your wife while we were standing. Nobody sat the entire night in that arena, I don't think. And we now knew something big was going to happen, and it was a big moment for, well, it was a big moment for me. It was going to be a big moment for everyone, because these two men had not been seen playing music together, of course, since 1988. And we know what that pairing means. And I just remember like feeling almost like lightheaded in anticipation. When was this going to happen? I was trying to focus on the show, which I thought was amazing, but also knowing that this was out there. It was just it really crazy.
Well, he really let it unfold that it's at a nice leisurely pace. And in that time, you got an amazing version of Settle for Love with Joe Ely. It's Joe Ely's song. I guess, was this the first time, or that tour was the first time that Bruce actually said to a guest, hey, let's play one of your songs. And because he did it with Elliot Murphy the previous summer in Paris. I think it was called Rock Ballad. Not exactly the most, I think it was an acoustic song, actually. And then he did Settle for Love with Ely in, I guess it was Dublin. And obviously we have a soundboard of that one. That sounds amazing. And of course, I guess two more songs with Jerry Lee Lewis at that show. And then back here. And so I guess this may be the first time it ever happened in the States that Bruce was playing a song with his band for somebody else or for somebody else to sing lead vocals.
Right. And Joe Ely did a great job. Tough position to be in because, again, the anticipation was rising, and here was this guy none of us knew who he was really singing the song, but because it was so good, we all went with it.
Yeah, it's a great song. I wasn't familiar with it before this night, and I'm not going to say that I went out the next day and bought the album, but it certainly has stayed with me for a long time. And when I finally bought the bootleg, actually, I guess it was that December, it was actually one of my favorite tracks from that set.
Now, the next song featured a guest that was well-known to everyone, and of course, I'm referring to Little Steven, and they did Glory Days, and the crowd was ecstatic during that entire performance.
But again, that was a song that they had done every night on the tour.
Yes.
So it really wasn't that much of a stretch. You brought Steven out. He had been there the previous summer when he did it then, right? The last night at the Meadowlands, August 12th?
Steve had guested August 12th. I believe he was also on stage for Sandy and for Rosalita, but I'd have to double check that.
We really hadn't got to the envelope pushing at this point yet.
No, but I do think it is important to note the crowd was much more into the show, I think, than any of the shows the previous summer at the Meadowlands. The previous summer, especially the early shows, it's well reported how nervous Bruce was before the first show back in New Jersey in 1992. The audience was more of in a prove it to us mode. And while I do think that there were still doubts about this band, maybe because it was only one of two shows that were going to happen, or maybe because at this point, much of the crowd did know that Clarence was in the building. I think the crowd was more eager for a release this night than on some of the shows the year before.
Okay. Or maybe they had just accepted the band that this was not E Street and he wasn't going to be playing with E Street. So might as well enjoy who he's playing with now and just enjoy the music. And of course I love Bruce's line in that at the end of Glory Days about show the person next to you your underwear. I love that line. It always cracks me up.
That actually made me laugh when I was listening the other day as well.
Of course I always think back to the first part of that, going back to, you know, put your hands in the air like you just don't care. And then I believe Kenny Mayne on SportsCenter, we used to say, throw your hands in the air like you have no concern for repercussions. So I always go back to that in my mind anyway. Sorry to take away. Go back to ESPN SportsCenter with that one.
And now dragging it out a little bit more, that anticipation and allowing this encore to build. He took the stage alone for Thunder Road, which had been done at most of the shows on the tour and certainly regularly in 93. But again, it was just a little bit of a respite in terms of the surging energy that was going on, especially after Steve was on stage. And then when Thunder Road ended, he called out and Southside came on stage. And of course, these two guys, the byplay between them is always so entertaining and they're giving each other the business. And even to now, as I think about it, like I feel like my heart start racing. And that's what I felt that night. I think at that point, I was trying to remember, your wife won't remember, but I think we were up on our seats. I think everyone on the floor at the start of It's Been a Long Time got up on their seats. And I just remember such glee in that building as Steve and Southside and Bruce sang It's Been a Long Time. That was the first time they'd ever done it on Bruce's stage. They had done it a couple of times on Southside's stage. And Claudine and I were lucky to be at the Pony one night when they did it. But to see it in this building with that crowd, with the way the show built, it was absolutely a perfect moment, even though it was about to be surpassed.
I love that album when it came out, obviously. And so I was thinking, yeah, this is it right here. You know, these three guys doing the song just like it's on the album with the horns. Just a tremendous performance. And it was, I believe it was the first time that all three sang in public, right? I believe when you saw him in December that Steve was not there. Is that correct?
He was not, no.
Okay. So this was the first time all three sang it together in public. And that was not lost on me. I was digging every minute of that one. And I had no idea what was coming. So I was just loving life at that point.
When the song ended, Bruce turned around and he counted down and 10th Avenue started. And this is really the most dramatic moment I've ever experienced at a concert. The song started to build. I think the band was pretty amped up. They were playing it too fast. Bruce said a little bit slower now, and they brought it down a little. And the crowd knew what was going on. And the volume in that arena started to rise as Bruce started to sing 10th Avenue, and it would peak about 2 minutes later when he sang the line "And the Change Was Made Uptown" and the big man joined the band. And I don't think any of us in that building, in the audience or on the stage for that matter, has ever experienced anything like the sound in that building when Clarence walked out on the stage.
Yeah, that was pretty freaking loud. I remember on the bootlegs, it drowned out the music. It's not quite that way on the official release, but it's there. And of course, if you're listening and you were there like we were, you remember back to that moment and the excitement that we felt in that arena. I remember I was, as I said, I made friends with these guys. They're about 10 or 15 years older than me, and I actually lifted one of them in the air when Clarence came on. I was like, holy crap, he's here. So that was, that was pretty mind-blowing. That was mind-blowing because as you keep pointing out, I had no idea what was in store for us when it finally happened.
Boy, that really does give it a totally different perspective of when he walked out on that stage, you didn't know in advance that he was there. That was pretty mind-blowing.
It was. It's like, I think there might have been whispers in the audience, or you know, I heard Clarence is here, but you know how that stuff goes. You don't know what's real, and obviously it's almost like a game of telephone with your friends, and you never know what's right, what's wrong. And so I just kind of took it all with a grain of salt, but just like, he's here. Oh my God, he's here.
And of course his mic was not operational. Now on the archive release, you can hear the sax. I actually wrote the review for Backstreets. At the time, I pressed really hard to get an answer to find out how they had the sax there. We were told that the sax actually was recorded. For some reason, it didn't go out to the arena, but that they did have the track on the tape. Some people are dubious of that. All I can say is that's what we were told. Tough situation for them either way, because if they did import it from another show, which again is not what we were told, but to not have any sax on the track in this moment when Clarence has just walked out on stage for this absolutely historic guest spot would have also been weird on the archive. Don't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. But I believe Steve and Bruce put their vocal mics up to his saxophone to make sure it was heard. I believe they even knew that it wasn't going out.
That was
PA.
During Born to Run, not during 10th Avenue.
Okay, yeah. My bad. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then what the weirdest thing about the archive release was that you hear him say, "And kid, you better get the picture." And
right.
I don't remember hearing that anywhere, either in the arena or on the bootleg. Do you?
I don't. And again, we inquired about these things. I can only report what I was told at the time. I try not to let that be too big of a deal for me because my personal opinion is generally they shouldn't be playing around with these archive releases too much. Now, this is, again, a very difficult spot for them if, in fact, they didn't have the sax. But if they did put in the line of him singing, that doesn't make anywhere near as much sense.
Not at all. That would have been weird. So I wonder, if Clarence has some kind of mic down there, or did he, maybe he just sang it into his sax mic. I guess that was soon to crap out on him, but that was wild. That was weird to hear it on the official release.
And it was a moment that could never be repeated. I think for the fans, it was really their chance to show their love for the E Street Band, which had gone away without anyone knowing that they were going away. When we last saw them in 88, nobody knew they were going to be fired. And then they were gone, and Bruce was here with this new band. And it was just fabulous that all of those guys, Steve, Max, who would join the stage in a moment, Bruce, Southside, that they were all on stage during this incredible set of encores and able to all reconnect and really symbolize what the Jersey Shore had stood for all those years.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, having Clarence there and the warmth and the love that he was shown, that was, yeah, they hadn't had a chance to say goodbye, basically, in 88. I mean, he didn't even play New Jersey in 88. So having that opportunity in that building to show some love to him, I think, meant a lot to the fans and obviously to him, too.
And from there, as Bruce said, we can't have the big man here without doing this one. They did Born to Run. As you noted, Bruce and Steve helped make sure that his solo was projected to that venue, because the crowd, and some of it may have been just the extreme noise, you really couldn't hear anything. It was all a blur. I mean, when I listen back to it now, I think back to just that blur of energy and noise, and it was really, have you ever experienced anything like that ever again?
No, never. I think that was it. I think that was the impromptu reunion, even though I'm sure it was planned days in advance of the E Street Band. And obviously the next time they played New Jersey, it was the E Street Band. It was officially Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. So that moment was a huge deal at the time.
There's only one other time that I can really think of where the crowd was anywhere near that loud and gave me the sort of goosebumps that I had that night. And that, of course, was on July 1st, 2000, similarly when the E Street Band chant started.
Oh, okay. I can see that. I don't think the crowd was that loud that
no,
night.
No, it was nothing was as loud as what happened here.
I think the emotion was certainly there on July 1st, 2000, but it wasn't as loud as it was that night. As you said, nothing was that loud. Maybe the Beatles, right?
That's what it really, I think, must have been like. That's how loud it was.
Right. And you know who I think was incredibly happy to have Clarence there? Crystal.
Crystal Talley. Yes.
Crystal Taliaferro. Taliaferro. I can't say her name. She must have been relieved to have Clarence take his solo back after playing it for the entire tour. And that was one solo that could never be replicated by anybody else. And it always sounded so thin. She tried her best, but it just wasn't the best opportunity or the best situation for her. She was not meant to play the sax on Born to Run.
No, and we're not going to get into any negativity over the next show, but I think part of the problem with what occurred there was the fact that, as we know, the E Street Band reunion happened two nights earlier, and at the Garden, fans had expectations now that were not going to be met. And it was weird that night at the Garden that Crystal played the sax solo after hearing Clarence doing two nights earlier. But again, that we're not going to get into that tonight. And we're talking about this classic show, but it is worthy of pointing out. After Born to Run, he went with what had become the traditional part of the encores on that tour, My Beautiful Ward. And then he brought back out Joe Ely, Susie Tyrell making an appearance with Patty at this show. And was this the first time they played Blown Down This Road?
I believe so. I can't imagine another time when they played it, but I could be, it was not familiar with me at the time. So I believe this was it. I was pretty encyclopedic by this point in terms of what had and had not been played. And I think this was the E Street debut, not E Street debut. God. This was the live debut from Bruce of this song. And I had forgotten that Susie was there until I was listening to it the other day. And it's like, wow, that's a violin with, I assume that's Susie, but I could be wrong. And then of course, you know, Patty was there. That's gotta be the most Hootenanny like time of any time that Bruce has had on stage. It may be the sound check at that second holiday show in 2000, but I think this might beat it.
Well, and a very curious choice. Well done, but a curious choice in the middle of the E Street reunion to drop this sort of hootenanny in there. But I think the crowd was just so blissful at that point, they went with it.
they were all smoking a cigarette by this point. but Bruce did kind of, he brought it home. He basically said, he said, I opened the show with the Woody Guthrie song, so I'm going to play another one here. And that song is about not having enough. About having enough food, and that ties it back in, obviously, to the entire point of the evening of raising money to relieve hunger in New Jersey.
And a good pairing with My Beautiful Reward. Now, I think what Bruce was looking to do here was sort of punctuate, as you said, the theme of the evening before going back to the Jersey Shore celebration. And that is what happened, because after Blown Down This Road, he brought back out Southside, Patty, the horns. And if Steven. The last song was a hootenanny, this was pure Jersey Shore soul music, because they went into having a party. And that's not something that I think this is probably the only time, actually, that Bruce has done having a party, a full version. I'm not talking about like the 60-second abbreviated just him and Steve version that was done July 31st, 2012 or anything like that. This is the only full version of the song he's ever done at one of his own shows, right?
I think so. I believe the 77, New Year's Eve 77. I want to feel like he did it then, but it was with Southside and the Asbury Jukes and the E Street Band. So maybe that doesn't really count. But no, it's never been, I don't think it's ever been done otherwise at an actual Springsteen concert.
God, it was so good.
That was amazing. Yeah, I got to. That was something else, because I don't think I seen Southside much at all up to that point. I saw him a lot in the like 93 on, and I don't think I'd ever seen him do that song. So that was fun. That was amazing.
Actually, I was all in on Southside at that point. We had been going in the 80s to the Ritz in New York City, and of course down to the Shore and at whatever theater shows he played. And he also played the Garden State Arts Center a bunch of times. And it was great to see him there. And the love that those men have for one another still to this day is, it's just great to see. And it really speaks to the scene. And that was what was being captured here. It was about brotherhood and camaraderie. And that was what the audience felt too, and I still feel it listening to this show 30 years later.
Yeah, there was a bond there that they'd all that had been created down in Asbury Park, and they brought that bond to this show, and everybody was on their best behavior, and it was certainly a moment to be had, and not replicated since at all.
No.
I guess they never did have a party at the holiday shows, but they certainly did some of this other material. So yes. I guess just having a party does kind of stand on its own.
And that was followed by Jersey Girl, Max guesting, as well as the horns. And I think we figured it was going to be the capper to the evening. It, again, was very sweet and well-received by the crowd, but it wound up that there would be one more song after Jersey Girl.
Well, I thought Jersey Girl sounded really good. I had forgotten that the horns played on it. And so listening earlier, I thought, wow, this is actually a really good version, because I'm not usually a fan of this song. Sometimes I feel like he panders to the Jersey crowd when he plays this. And so I'm a little it's a little off-putting to me, but that version with the horns sounded really, really good. I was kind of surprised he didn't introduce Max before the song, but he did it at the end. That was, I thought he would have done it earlier.
And then they did have the one final song, which they had played a bunch of times in Europe.
Like every night for the previous month, right?
Yeah. It's All Right, which Southside guested on, Steve Van Zandt guested on, the horns guested on, and Bobby King, who was a member of the 92-93 band, was featured on the song very effectively.
Actually, I forgot. Bobby King sang on Having a Party as well. He had some lead vocals on that one.
Yeah,
that
sounded true.
Pretty good. Doing some soul twisting. Some soul twisting. But yeah, it's all right. I forgot that Southside was on it. I didn't hear him on the recording. But yeah, that was. It's almost like it was anticlimactic with that one. But I think it worked quite well in it, despite that.
Yeah, and it was very late at that point.
This was almost a 4-hour show.
Yes, and of course they took a break in the middle.
Yes, so we didn't get out of there till way past midnight, if memory serves.
That I believe is correct.
Yeah, and then I went to the Jersey Shore and got so drunk I couldn't see. Anyway, great show, right, Hal?
yeah, great is an understatement. Again, it's hard to account for, I think, my youthful exuberance. Thinking back on it now, this really is one of the high points for me. I know it's not an E Street Band show, but just the way the night unfolded and the level of happiness and what was experienced that night, just truly memorable experience.
Oh my God, it was such an amazing night. Just the solid set, the performance was just, as you said, that was one of the best that they did on that tour. And then to cap it with the Jersey set, basically, it's hard to top this kind of show because there hasn't been that kind of absence. And it was, this show could not be repeated at this point.
No, this show was a one-time only thing. A lot of people will be happy about that because it meant that Bruce eventually got back with the band and stayed with them. Of course, certain members of the band, unfortunately, are no longer with us. And I think in a way it makes this night even that more powerful. Again, just seeing the bond between Bruce and Clarence, who really were the symbol of the E Street Band together, of course, on the cover of Born to Run and the Kiss on stage during the Born in the USA tour. These two men symbolized the band itself, the relationship with the band and its fans, and to see them back together, it really was indescribable.
Exactly. And then Bruce paid Clarence back 4 days later than at the Trade Winds.
I was very fortunate to be there.
Exactly. I didn't know about that. I did not go. But yeah, that was a pretty fun show from what I could tell on the recording anyway.
That was a good night. And the next night, I was not at the Letterman taping. Of course, it was the last show of Late Night with David Letterman, a seminal show for all of us who had been in college around that time. And he'd always wanted to have Bruce on, and Bruce made an unannounced appearance at the end of the final show, closing out Letterman on NBC. He did Glory Days and got up on the piano. And that was an amazing moment itself. And then, of course, the next night they would wind up at the Garden. We've talked about it before. We're not going to get into it here. The circumstances of that show were certainly different than what took place at the Meadowlands because of an incident with the crowd. But the 92-93 band wrapped things up with a benefet in memory of Kristen Ann Carr, who had passed away earlier that year. And then I went off and moved across the country. And you were done with college and started your post-collegiate life. And Bruce moved forward, and we all just wound up in places. I don't know. I mean, like, you think back on it now, it's very powerful. It's very powerful to think about those nights and to think personally about what they meant. And then to know, you know, what we walked out into, which was massive changes in certainly my life and yours.
Yeah. And then never knew when Bruce was going to take the stage again. That was always the feeling after every tour, especially after 88, where he took the 4.5-year break. And you know, it was still almost 2.5 years later before he embarked on an actual tour. And of course, between June 93 and November 95, a lot of stuff happened. As you said, the quick reunion with the E Street Band in 95 to record the tracks for Greatest Hits, and then to make a couple of appearances unannounced and announced. And then, of course, he, as you said, he recorded an album with the 92 band. Never heard it. Haven't heard it.
Hopefully we hope to hear it.
We hope to hear it one day. And yeah, it was it was definitely kind of a closing of a chapter in Bruce's career. And he opened up another one 2.5 years later. And then, of course, another one in 99 with the full reunion tour with the band. And here we are.
And I just want to point out, we've actually done several episodes about this period in the early 90s. All the way back in the first year of the show, we did one called I'm Your Detail Man, Springsteen in 1994-95, which actually covers much of what Flynn just talked about. So go back and check out those episodes. In fact, I believe it was one of those episodes that our buddy Kirk Minahan said was what really turned him onto the show, that we were talking about such little known periods of Bruce's career.
Well, we also did the one between 88 and 92. I thought that one was just as interesting because so little is known about that time. And it's a very mysterious time. And of course, 94 and 95 were a little bit less mysterious, but they were certainly, Bruce was quite active. He just couldn't seem to figure out what he wanted to do until he finally came upon the Jode concept, the Jode album, and then the subsequent tour.
Well, I think that's the lasting impression of these shows, was that he really didn't fully know what he wanted to do. He had put this new band together. They had come to the end of this tour. He had reunited with E Street. I think most of the audience was hoping, certainly, that the E Street reunion would continue, and certainly that they would tour sooner than they wound up touring. But eventually he found his path, and it was through the ghost of Tom Joad. And I think that did help set up much of what was to come later when he did reunite with the band. We've talked about this before in 1999. And, you know, here we sit today and they're on tour in 2023. So it's just, again, a very powerful thing to look back on. And just for speaking for myself, really great past 30 years.
Oh, absolutely. I was thinking more along the lines of the last 24 just being amazing. But yeah, I got to extend it back to 92. And hard to believe it's been 31 years since that tour kicked off. June 15th, 92 in Stockholm. Time flies, man.
Really, where does it go? But anyway, we don't want to get started on that. I'll just bring this to a close now and wrap things up. None But the Brave is presented by Evergreen Podcast. It's produced by Bull Market Entertainment. If you haven't had a chance yet, please check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/NBTB Podcast. And on Twitter, you can find us at NBTB Podcast.
So for Hal Schwartz, I'm Flynn McLean saying thanks for listening. And we'll see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much. We'll be seeing you.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5 Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.